Chapter 13. Ford Prefect bounded up to the bridge of the Heart of Gold. "Trillian! Arthur!" he shouted. "It's working! The ship's reactivated!" Trillian and Arthur were asleep on the floor. "Come on, you guys, we're going! We're off!" he said, kicking them awake.
"Hi there, guys!"
twittered the computer.
"It's really great to be back with you again, I can tell you, and I just want to say that..."
"Shut up!" said Ford. "Just tell us where the hell we are!" "Frogstar World B, and man, it's a dump!" said Zaphod, running onto the bridge. "Hi, guys. You must be so amazingly glad to see me. You can't even find words to tell me what a cool fruit I am." "What a what?" said Arthur, blearily picking himself up from the floor and not taking any of this in. "I know how you feel," said Zaphod. "I'm so great. Even I get tongue-tied talking to myself. Hey, it's good to see you, Trillian. Ford, Monkey Man. Hey, computer."
"Hi there, Mr. Beale Bruxer. It sure is a great honor to..."
"Shut up and get us out of here. Fast, fast, fast."
"Sure thing, fella. Where do you want to go?"
"Anywhere! Doesn't matter," shouted Zaphod. "Yes, it does," he said again. "We want to go to the nearest place to eat."
"Sure thing,"
said the computer happily, and a massive explosion rocked the bridge. When Zaniwoop entered, a minute or so later, with a black eye, he regarded the four wisps of smoke with interest. Chapter 14. Four inert bodies sank through spinning blackness. Consciousness had died. Cold oblivion pulled the bodies down and down into the pit of unbeing. The roar of silence echoed dismally around them, and they sank at last into a dark and bitter sea of heaving red that slowly engulfed them, seemingly forever. After what seemed an eternity, the sea receded and left them lying on a cold, hard shore, the flotsam and jetsam of the stream of life, the universe, and everything. Cold spasms shook them. Lights danced sickeningly around them. The cold, hard shore tipped and spanned and then stood still. It shone darkly. It was a very highly polished, cold, hard shore. A green blur watched them disapprovingly. It coughed. "Good evening, madam, gentlemen," it said. "Do you have a reservation?" Fort Prefect's consciousness snapped back like elastic, making his brain smart. He looked up woozily at the green blur. "Reservation?" he said weakly.
Yes, sir," said the green blur.
"Do you need a reservation for the afterlife?"
Insofar as it is possible for a green blur to arch its eyebrows disdainfully, this is what the green blur now did.
"Afterlife, sir?" it said.
Arthur Dent was grappling with his consciousness the way one grapples with a lost bar of soap in the bath.
"Is this the afterlife?"
he stammered.
"Well, I assume so,"
said Ford Prefect, trying to work out which way was up. He tested the theory that it must lie in the opposite direction from the cold, hard shore on which he was lying, and staggered to what he hoped were his feet.
"I mean," he said, swaying gently, "there's no way we could have survived that blast, is there?"
"No," muttered Arthur. He had raised himself up onto his elbows, but it didn't seem to improve things. He slumped down again.
"No," said Trillian, standing up. "No way at all."
A dull, hoarse, gurgling sound came from the floor. It was Zaphod Beeblebrox attempting to speak.
"I certainly didn't survive," he gurgled. "I was a total goner, wham, bang, and that was it."
"Yeah, thanks to you," said Ford. "We didn't stand a chance. We must have been blown to bits, arms, legs, everywhere."
"Yeah," said Zaphod, struggling noisily to his feet.
"If the lady and gentleman would care to order drinks," said the green blur, hovering impatiently beside them.
"Kapow, splat!" continued Zaphod, "instantaneously zonked into our component molecules. Hey, Ford," he said, identifying one of the slowly solidifying blurs around him. "Did you get that thing of your whole life flashing before you?"
"You got that too," said Ford, "your whole life?"
"Yeah," said Zaphod. "At least I assume it was mine. I spent a lot of time out of my skulls, you know."
He looked around him at the various shapes that were at last becoming proper shapes instead of vague and wobbling shapeless shapes.
"So," he said.
"So what?" said Ford.
"So here we are," said Zaphod hesitantly. "Lying dead."
"Standing," Trillin corrected him.
"Standing dead," continued Zaphod, "in this desolate
restaurant," said Arthur Dent, who had got to his feet and could now, much to his surprise, see clearly. That is to say, the thing that surprised him was not that he could see, but what he could see.
"Here we are," continued Zaphod doggedly, "standing dead in this desolate..."
"Five-star," said Trillian. "Restaurant," concluded Zaphod. "Odd, isn't it?" said Ford.
Yeah.
"Nice chandeliers, though," said Trillian. They looked about themselves in bemusement.
"It's not so much an afterlife," said Arthur, "more a sort of après-vie."
The chandeliers were, in fact, a little on the flashy side, and the low-vaulted ceiling from which they hung would not, in an ideal universe, have been painted in that particular shade of deep turquoise. And even if it had been, it wouldn't have been highlighted by concealed mood lighting. This is not, however, an ideal universe, as was further evidenced by the eye-crossing patterns of the inlaid marble floor and the way in which the fronting for the 80-yard-long marble-topped bar had been made. The fronting for the 80-yard-long marble-topped bar had been made by stitching together nearly 20,000 Antarian mosaic lizard skins, despite the fact that the 20,000 lizards concerned had needed them to keep their insides in. A few smartly dressed creatures were lounging casually at the bar or relaxing in the richly coloured, body-hugging seats that were deployed here and there about the bar area. A young Vlaherg officer and his green, steaming young lady passed through the large smoked glass doors at the far end of the bar into the dazzling light of the main body of the restaurant beyond. Behind Arthur was a large, curtained bay window. He pulled aside a corner of the curtain and looked out at a bleak and drear landscape, grey, pockmarked and dismal, a landscape which, under normal circumstances, would have given Arthur the creeping horrors. These were not, however, normal circumstances, for the thing that froze his blood and made his skin try to crawl up his back and off the top of his head was the sky. The sky was... An attendant flunky politely drew the curtain back into place. "All in good time, sir," he said. Zaphod's eyes flashed.
"Hey, hang about, you dead guys," he said. "I think we're missing some ultra-important thing here, you know. Something somebody said, and we missed it."
Arthur was profoundly relieved to turn his attention from what he had just seen. He said, "I said it was a sort of apres."
"Yeah, and don't you wish you hadn't," said Zaphod. "Ford?"
"I said it was odd."
"Yeah, shrewd but dull. Perhaps it was..."
"Perhaps," interrupted the green blur, who had by this time resolved into the shape of a small, wizened, dark-suited green waiter. "Perhaps you'd care to discuss the matter over drinks."
"Drinks!" cried Zaphod. "That was it! See what you miss if you don't stay alert!"
"Indeed, sir," said the waiter patiently. "If the lady and gentleman would care to take drinks before dinner..."
"Dinner!"
Zaphod exclaimed with passion. "Listen, little green person, my stomach could take you home and cuddle you all night for the mere idea." "And the universe," continued the waiter, determined not to be deflected on his homestretch, "will explode later for your pleasure." Ford's head swiveled slowly towards him. He spoke with feeling.
"Wow," he said, "what sort of drinks do you serve in this place?"
The waiter laughed a polite little waiter's laugh. "He said, "I think sir has perhaps misunderstood me."
"Oh, I hope not," breathed Ford.
The waiter coughed a polite little waiter's cough. "It is not unusual for our customers to be a little disoriented by the time journey," he said, "so if I might suggest..."
"Time journey?" said Zaphod. "Time journey?" said Ford. "Time journey?" said Trillian.
"You mean this isn't the afterlife?" said Arthur. The waiter smiled a polite little waiter's smile. He had almost exhausted his polite little waiter repertoire and would soon be slipping into his role of a rather tight-lipped and sarcastic little waiter. "Afterlife, sir," he said. "No, sir."
"And we're not dead?" said Arthur.
The waiter tightened his lips. He said, "sir is most evidently alive, otherwise I would not attempt to serve, sir." In an extraordinary gesture, which it is pointless attempting to describe, Zaphod Beeblebrox slapped both his foreheads with two of his arms and one of his thighs with the other. "Hey, guys," he said, "this is crazy. We did it. We finally got to where we were going. This is Milliways."
"Milliways?" said Ford.
"Yes, sir," said the waiter, laying on the patience with a trowel. "This is Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe."
"End of what?" said Arthur.
"The universe," repeated the waiter, very clearly and unnecessarily distinctly.
"When did that end?" said Arthur.
"In just a few minutes, sir," said the waiter. He took a deep breath. He didn't need to do this because his body was supplied with the peculiar assortment of gases it required for survival from a small intravenous device strapped to his leg. There are times, however, when, whatever your metabolism, you have to take a deep breath. "And now, if you would care to order your drinks at last," he said, "I will then show you to your table." Zaphod grinned two manic grins, sauntered over to the bar, and bought most of it. Chapter 15. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It has been built on the fragmented remains of... It will be built on the fragmented... That is to say, it will have been built by this time, and indeed has been. One of the major problems encountered in time travel is not that of accidentally becoming your own father or mother. There is no problem involved in becoming your own father or mother that a broad-minded and well-adjusted family can't cope with. There is also no problem about changing the course of history. The course of history does not change because it all fits together like a jigsaw. All the important changes have happened before the things they were supposed to change, and it all sorts itself out in the end. The major problem is quite simply one of grammar, and the main work to consult in this matter is Dr. Dan Streetmenschner's Time Traveller's Handbook of 1001 Tense Formations. It will tell you, for instance, how to describe something that was about to happen to you in the past before you avoided it by time-jumping forward 2 days in order to avoid it. The event will be described differently according to whether you are talking about it from the standpoint of your own natural time, from a time in the further future, or a time in the further past, and is further complicated by the possibility of conducting conversations whilst you are actually travelling from one time to another with the intention of becoming your own mother or father. Most readers get as far as the future semi-conditionally modified sub-inverted plagal past subjunctive intentional before giving up. And in fact, in later editions of the book, all pages beyond this point have been left blank to save on printing costs. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy skips lightly over this tangle of academic abstraction, pausing only to note that the term future perfect has been abandoned since it was discovered not to be. To resume. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It is built on the fragmented remains of an eventually ruined planet which is, or we all haven't be, enclosed in a vast time bubble and projected forward in time to the precise moment of the end of the universe. This is, many would say, impossible. In it, guests take, willen on take, their places at table and eat, willen on eat, sumptuous meals whilst watching, willing watchin', the whole of creation explode around them. This, many would say, is equally impossible. You can arrive, may and arrive and on when, for any sitting you like without prior, late for when, reservation, because you can book retrospectively, as it were, when you return to your own time. You can have on book have enter for when pre-sooning, returning when to retro home. This is, many would now insist, absolutely impossible. At the restaurant you can meet and dine with, may and meet and con with dine and on when, a fascinating cross-section of the entire population of space and time. This, it can be explained patiently, is also impossible. You can visit it as many times as you like, may and on visit, re on visiting, and so on. For further tense correction, consult Dr. Streetmenschner's book. And be sure of never meeting yourself because of the embarrassment this usually causes. This, even if the rest were true, which it isn't, is patently impossible, say the doubters. All you have to do is deposit one penny in a savings account in your own era, and when you arrive at the end of time, The operation of compound interest means that the fabulous cost of your meal has been paid for. This, many claim, is not merely impossible, but clearly insane, which is why the advertising executives of the star system of Bastablon came up with this slogan. If you've done 6 impossible things this morning, why not round it off with breakfast at Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe? Chapter 16. At the bar, Zaphod was rapidly becoming as tired as a newt. His heads knocked together and his smiles were coming out of sync. He was miserably happy. "Zaphod," said Ford, "whilst you're still capable of speech, would you care to tell me what the photon happened? Where have you been? Where have we been? Small matter, but I'd like it cleared up." Zaphod's left head sobered up, leaving his right to sink further into the obscurity of drink. Yeah, he said, "I've been around. They want me to find the man who rules the universe, but I don't care to meet him. I believe the man can't cook." His left head watched his right head saying this and then nodded. "True," it said, "have another drink." Ford had another pangalactic gargle blaster, the drink which has been described as the alcoholic equivalent of a mugging, expensive and bad for the head. Whatever had happened, Ford decided, he didn't really care too much. "Listen, Ford," said Zaphod, "everything's cool and fruity."
"You mean everything's under control?"
"Nope," said Zaphod, "I do not mean everything's under control. That would not be cool and fruity. If you want to know what happened, let's just say I had the whole situation in my pocket, okay?"
Ford shrugged. Zaphod giggled into his drink. It frothed up over the side of the glass and started to eat its way into the marble bar top. A wild-skinned sky gypsy approached them and played electric violin at them until Zaphod gave him a lot of money and he agreed to go away again. The gypsy approached Arthur and Trillian, sitting in another part of the bar.
"I don't know what this place is," said Arthur, "but I think it gives me the creeps."
"Have another drink," said Trillian. "Enjoy yourself."
"Which?" said Arthur. "The two are mutually exclusive."
"Poor Arthur. You're not really cut out for this life, are you?"
"You call this life?"
"You're beginning to sound like Marvin. Marvin is the clearest thinker I know. How do you think we make this violinist go away?"
The waiter approached.
"Your table is ready," he said.
Seen from the outside, which it never is, the restaurant resembles a giant, glittering starfish beached on a forgotten rock. Each of its arms house the bars, the kitchens, the force field generators which protect the entire structure and the decayed hunk of planet on which it sits, and the time turbines which slowly rock the whole affair backwards and forwards across the crucial moment. In the center sits the gigantic golden dome, almost a complete globe, and it was into this area that Zaphod, Ford, Arthur, and Trillian now passed. At least 5 tons of glitter alone had gone into it before them, and covered every available surface. The other surfaces were not available because they were already encrusted with jewels, precious seashells from Santragenus, gold leaf, mosaic tiles, lizard skins, and a million unidentifiable embellishments and decorations. Glass glittered, silver shone, gold gleamed, Arthur Dent goggled.
"Howie," said Zaphod, "Zappo!"
"Incredible," breathed Arthur. "The people, the things."
"The things," said Ford Prefect quietly, "are also people."
"The people," resumed Arthur, "the other people."
"The lights," said Trillian.
"The tables," said Arthur.
"The clothes," said Trillian. The waiter thought they sounded like a couple of bailiffs.
"The end of the universe is very popular," said Zaphod, threading his way unsteadily through the throng of tables, some made of marble, some of rich ultra-mahogany, some even of platinum, and at each a party of exotic creatures chatting amongst themselves and studying menus.
People like to dress up for it," continued Zaphod. "Gives it a sense of occasion."
The tables were fanned out in a large circle around a central stage area where a small band was playing light music. At least 1,000 tables was Arthur's guess. And interspersed among them were swaying palms, hissing fountains, grotesque statuary, in short, all the paraphernalia common to all restaurants where little expense has been spared to give the impression that no expense has been spared.
Arthur glanced around, half expecting to see someone making an American Express commercial. Zaphod lurched into Ford, who lurched back into Zaphod.
"Wowee," said Zaphod.
"Zappo," said Ford.
"My great-granddaddy must have really screwed up the computer's works, you know," said Zaphod. "I told it to take us to the nearest place to eat, and it sends us to the end of the universe. Remind me to be nice to it one day."
He paused.
"Hey, everybody's here, you know. Everybody who was anybody."
"Was?" said Arthur.
"Well, at the end of the universe, you have to use the past tense a lot," said Zaphod, "because everything's been done, you know. Hi, guys!" he called out to a nearby party of giant iguana life forms. "How did you do?"
"Is that Zaphod Beeblebrox?" asked one iguana of another iguana.
"I think so," replied the second iguana.
"Well, doesn't that just take that biscuit?" said the first iguana.
"Funny old thing, life," said the second iguana.
"It's what you make it," said the first, and they lapsed back into silence. They were waiting for the greatest show in the universe.
"Hey, Zaphod," said Ford, grabbing for his arm, and on account of the third pangalactic gargle blaster missing, he pointed a swaying finger.
"There's an old mate of mine," he said, "Hot Black Desiato. See the man at the platinum table with the platinum suit on?"
Zaphod tried to follow Ford's fingers with his eyes, but it made him feel dizzy. Finally, he saw.
"Oh, yeah," he said.
Then recognition came a moment later.
"Hey," he said, "did that guy ever make it mega big? Wow, bigger than the biggest thing ever, other than me."
"Who's he supposed to be?" asked Trillian.
"Hot Black Desiato," said Zaphod in astonishment. "You don't know? You never heard of Disaster Area?"
No, said Trillian, who hadn't.
"The biggest," said Ford, "loudest, richest," suggested Zaphod. "Rock band and the history of..."
He searched for the word.
"History itself," said Zaphod.
"No," said Trillian.
"Zowie," said Zaphod. "Here we are at the end of the universe and you haven't even lived yet. Did you miss out?"
He led her off to where the waiter had been waiting all this time at the table. Arthur followed them, feeling very lost and alone. Ford waded off through the throng to renew an old acquaintance.
"Hey, Hot Black," he called out. "How are you doing? Great to see you, big boy. How's the noise? You're looking great. Really very, very fat and unwell. Amazing."
He slapped the man on the back and was mildly surprised that it seemed to elicit no response. The pangalactic gargle blaster swilling around inside him told him to plunge on regardless.
"Remember the old days," he said, "we used to hang out, right? The Bistro Illegal, remember? Slim's Throat Emporium, the Evil Drone Boozerama, great days, eh?"
Hot Black Desiato offered no opinion as to whether they were great days or not. Ford was not perturbed.
"And when we were hungry, you'd pose as public health inspectors, you remember that? And go around confiscating meals and drinks, right, till we got a food poisoning? Oh, and then there were the long nights of talking and drinking in those smelly rooms above the Café Lou in Gretchentown, New Beetle. And you were always in the next room trying to write songs on your adjuvitar, and we all hated them. And you said you didn't care, and we said we did because we hated them so much."
Ford's eyes were beginning to mist over.
"And you said you didn't want to be a star," he continued, wallowing in nostalgia, "'cause you despised the star system. And we said, you know, Hadra and Sully Joe and me, we said that we didn't think you had the option. And what do you do now? You buy star systems!"
He turned and solicited the attention of those at nearby tables.
"Here," he said, "is a man who buys star systems!"
Hot Black Desiato made no attempt either to confirm or deny this fact, and the attention of the temporary audience waned rapidly.
"I think somebody's drunk," muttered a purple bush-like being into his wine glass.
Ford staggered slightly and sat down heavily on the chair facing Hot Black Desiato.
"What's that number you do?" he said,
unwisely grabbing at a bottle for support and tipping it over into a nearby glass as it happened. Not to waste a happy accident, he drained the glass.
"That really huge number," he continued. "How does it go? Blam, blam, ba-da! Something, and in the stage act you do it, it ends up with a ship crashing right into the sun, and you actually do it!"
Ford crashed his fist into his other hand to illustrate this feat graphically. He knocked the bottle over again.
"Ship, sun, wham, bang," he cried. "I mean, forget lasers and stuff. You guys are in a solar flares and real sunburn. Oh, and terrible songs."
His eyes followed the stream of liquid glugging out of the bottle on the table. Something ought to be done about it, he thought.
"Hey, you want a drink?" he said.
It began to sink into his squelching mind that something was missing from this reunion, and that the missing something was in some way connected with the fact that the fat man sitting opposite him in the platinum suit and the silvery trilby
had not yet said, "Hi, Ford," or "Great to see you after all this time," or in fact, anything at all. More to the point, he'd not even moved.
"Hot black," said Ford.
A large, meaty hand landed on his shoulder from behind and pushed him aside. He slid gracelessly off his seat and peered upwards to see if he could spot the owner of this discourteous hand. The owner was not hard to spot, on account of his being something of the order of 7 feet tall, and not slightly built with it. In fact, he was built the way one builds leather sofas, shiny, lumpy, and with lots of solid stuffing. The suit into which the man's body had been stuffed looked as if its only purpose in life was to demonstrate how difficult it was to get this sort of body into a suit. The face had the texture of an orange and the colour of an apple, but there the resemblance to anything sweet ended.
"Kid,"
said a voice which emerged from the man's mouth as if it had been having a really rough time down in his chest.
Yeah?
Said Ford conversationally. He staggered back to his feet again and was disappointed that the top of his head didn't come further up the man's body.
"Beat it," said the man.
"Oh, yeah?"
said Ford, wondering how wise he was being.
"And who are you?"
The man considered this for a moment. He wasn't used to being asked this sort of question. Nevertheless, after a while, he came up with an answer.
"I'm the guy who's telling you to beat it," he said, "before you get it beaten for you."
"Now listen," said Ford nervously. He wished his head would stop spinning, settle down, and get to grips with the situation. "Now listen," he continued. "I am one of Hot Black's oldest friends, and..." He glanced at Hot Black Desiato, who still hadn't moved as much as an eyelash. "And," said Ford again, wondering what would be a good word to say after "and." The large man came up with a whole sentence to go after "and." He said it.
"And I am Mr. Desiato's bodyguard," it went. "And I am responsible for his body, and I am not responsible for yours, so take it away before it gets damaged."
"Now wait a minute," said Ford.
"No minutes," said the bodyguard. "No waiting. Mr. Desiato speaks to no one."
"Well, perhaps you'd let him say what he thinks about the matter himself," said Ford.
"He speaks to no one," bellowed the bodyguard.
Ford glanced anxiously at Hot Black again and was forced to admit to himself that the bodyguard did seem to have facts on his side. There was still not the slightest sign of movement, let alone keen interest in Ford's welfare. "Why?" said Ford. "What's the matter with him?" The bodyguard told him. Chapter 17. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy notes that Disaster Area, a plutonium rock band from the Gagrakaka mine zones, are generally held to be not only the loudest rock band in the galaxy, but in fact the loudest noise of any kind at all. Regular concertgoers judge that the best sound balance is usually to be heard from within large concrete bunkers some 37 miles from the stage, whilst the musicians themselves play their instruments by remote control from within a heavily insulated spaceship which stays in orbit around the planet, or, more frequently, around a completely different planet. Their songs are, on the whole, very simple, and mostly follow the familiar theme of boy-being meets girl-being beneath a silvery moon, which then explodes for no adequately explored reason. Many worlds have now banned their act altogether, sometimes for artistic reasons, but most commonly because the band's public address system contravenes local strategic arms limitations treaties. This has not, however, stopped their earnings from pushing back the boundaries of pure hypermathematics, and their chief research accountant has recently been appointed Professor of Neo-Mathematics at the University of Maximegalon, in recognition of both his general and his special theories of disaster area tax returns, in which he proves that the whole fabric of the space-time continuum is not merely curved, it is in fact totally bent. Ford staggered back to the table where Zaphod, Arthur and Trillian were sitting waiting for the fun to begin.
"Gotta have some food," said Ford.
"Hi, Ford," said Zaphod. "You speak to the big noise boy?" Ford waggled his head noncommittally.
"Hot Black, I sort of spoke to him, yeah."
"What did he say?"
"Well, not a lot, really. He's,
Yeah?
He's spending a year dead for tax reasons. I've got to sit down."
He sat down. The waiter approached. "Oh, would you like to see the menu?" he said, "or would you like to meet the dish of the day?"
"Huh?"
said Ford.
"Huh?"
said Arthur.
"Huh?"
said Trillian.
Oh, that's cool, said Zaphod. We'll meet the meat.
In a small room in one of the arms of the restaurant complex, a tall, thin, gangling figure pulled aside a curtain, and Oblivion looked him in the face. It was not a pretty face, perhaps because Oblivion had looked him in it so many times. It was too long for a start, the eyes too sunken and hooded, the cheeks too hollow. His lips were too thin and too long, and when they parted, his teeth looked too much like a recently polished bay window. The hands that held the curtain were long and thin, too. They were also cold. They lay lightly along the folds of the curtain and gave the impression that if he didn't watch them like a hawk, they would crawl away of their own accord and do something unspeakable in a corner. He let the curtain drop, and the terrible light that played on his features went off to play somewhere more healthy. He prowled around his small chamber like a mantis contemplating an evening's praying, finally settling in a rickety chair by a trestle table, where he leafed through a few sheets of jokes. A bell rang. He pushed the thin sheaf of papers aside and stood up. His hands brushed limply over some of the 1,000,000 rainbow-coloured sequins with which his jacket was festooned, and he was gone through the door. In the restaurant, the lights dimmed. The band quickened its pace. A single spotlight stabbed down into the darkness of the stairway that led up to the centre of the stage. Up the stairs bounded a tall, brilliantly coloured figure. He burst onto the stage, tripped lightly up to the microphone, removed it from its stand with one swoop of his long, thin hand, and stood for a moment, bowing left and right to the audience, acknowledging their applause, and displaying to them his bay window. He waved to his particular friends in the audience, even though there weren't any there, and waited for the applause to die down. He held up his hand and smiled a smile that stretched not merely from ear to ear, but seemed to extend some way beyond the mere confines of his face. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," he cried. "Thank you very much. Thank you so very much." He eyed them with a twinkling eye. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "the universe as we know it has now been in existence for over 170,000,000,000,000,000,000 years and will be ending in a little over half an hour. So welcome, one and all, to Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe." With a gesture, he deftly conjured another round of spontaneous applause. With another gesture, he cut it. "I am your host for tonight," he said. "My name is Max Quadlepleen." Everybody knew this. His act was famous throughout the known galaxy, but he said it for the fresh applause it generated, which he acknowledged with a disclaiming smile and wave. "And I've just come straight from the very, very other end of time, where I've been hosting a show at the Big Bang Burger Bar, where I can tell you we had a very exciting evening, ladies and gentlemen, and I will be with you right through this historic occasion, the end of history itself." Another burst of applause died away quickly as the lights dimmed down further. On every table, candles ignited themselves spontaneously, eliciting a slight gasp from all the diners and wreathing them in a thousand tiny flickering lights and a million intimate shadows. A tremor of excitement thrilled through the darkened restaurant as the vast golden dome above them began very, very slowly to dim, to darken, to fade. Max's voice was hushed as he continued. "So, ladies and gentlemen," he breathed, "the candles are lit, the band plays softly, and as the force-shielded dome above us fades into transparency, revealing a dark and sullen sky hung with the ancient light of livid, swollen stars, I can see we're all in for a fabulous evening's apocalypse." Even the soft tootling of the band faded away. A stunned shock descended on all those who had not seen this sight before. A monstrous, grisly light poured in on them. A hideous light. A boiling, pestilential light. A light that would have disfigured hell. The universe was coming to an end. For a few interminable seconds, the restaurant spun silently through the raging void. Then Max spoke again. "For those of you who ever hoped to see the light at the end of the tunnel," he said, "this is it!" The band struck up again. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," cried Max. "I'll be back with you again in just a moment. And meanwhile, I'll leave you in the very capable hands of Mr. Reg Nullify and his cataclysmic combo. Big hand, ladies and gentlemen, for Reg and the boys!" The baleful turmoil of the skies continued. Hesitantly, the audience began to clap and after a moment or so, normal conversation resumed. Max began his round of the table, swapping jokes, shouting with laughter, earning his living. A large dairy animal approached Zaphod Beeblebrox's table. A large, fat, meaty quadruped of the bovine type, with large, watery eyes, small horns, and what might almost have been an ingratiating smile on its lips.
"Good evening,"
it lowed, and sat back heavily on its haunches. "I am the main dish of the day. May I interest you in parts of my body?" It harrumphed and gurgled a bit, wriggled its hindquarters into a more comfortable position, and gazed peacefully at them. Its gaze was met by looks of startled bewilderment from Arthur and Trillian, a resigned shrug from Ford Prefect, and naked hunger from Zaphod Beeblebrox.
"Something off the shoulder, perhaps," suggested the animal, "braised in a white wine sauce."
"Your shoulder?" said Arthur in a horrified whisper.
"But naturally my shoulder, sir," mooed the animal contentedly. "Nobody else's is mine to offer."
Zaphod leapt to his feet and started prodding and feeling the animal's shoulder appreciatively.
"Or the rump is very good," murmured the animal. "I've been exercising it and eating plenty of grain, so there's a lot of good meat there."
It gave a mellow grunt, gurgled again, and started to chew the cud. It swallowed the cud again.
"Or a casserole of me, perhaps," it added.
"You mean this animal actually wants us to eat it?"
whispered Trillian to Ford.
"Me?" said Ford, with a glazed look in his eyes. "I don't mean anything."
"That's absolutely horrible," exclaimed Arthur. "That's the most revolting thing I've ever heard."
"What's the problem, Earthman?" said Zaphod, now transferring his attention to the animal's enormous rump.
"I just don't want to eat an animal that's standing there inviting me to," said Arthur. "It's heartless."
"Better than eating an animal that doesn't want to be eaten," said Zaphod.
"That's not the point," Arthur protested.
Then he thought about it for a moment.
"All right," he said, "maybe it is the point. I don't care. I'm not going to think about it now. I'll just..."
The universe raged about him in its death throes.
"I think I'll just have a green salad," he muttered.
"May I urge you to consider my liver?" asked the animal. "It must be very rich and tender by now. I've been force-feeding myself for months."
"A green salad," said Arthur emphatically.
"A green salad," said the animal, rolling his eyes disapprovingly at Arthur.
"Are you going to tell me," said Arthur, "that I shouldn't have a green salad?"
"Well," said the animal, "I know many vegetables that are very clear on that point, which is why it was eventually decided to cut through the whole tangled problem and breed an animal that actually wanted to be eaten and was capable of saying so clearly and distinctly. And here I am."
It managed a very slight bow.
"Glass of water, please," said Arthur. "Look," said Zaphod, "we want to eat. We don't want to make a meal of the issues. Four rare steaks, please, and hurry. We haven't eaten in 576,000 million years."
The animal staggered to its feet. It gave a mellow gurgle.
"A very wise choice, sir, if I may say so." "Very good," it said. "I'll just nip off and shoot myself."
He turned and gave a friendly wink to Arthur.
"Don't worry, sir," he said. "I'll be very humane."
It waddled unhurriedly off to the kitchen. A matter of minutes later, the waiter arrived with four huge steaming steaks. Zaphod and Ford wolfed straight into them without a second's hesitation. Trillian paused, then shrugged and started into hers. Arthur stared at his, feeling slightly ill.
"Hey, Earthman," said Zaphod, with a malicious grin on the face that wasn't stuffing itself. "What's eating you?"
And the band played on.